Blog Talk Radio.
Usually spread by non-passenger planes or jets. What at
first looks like contrails, turns into ribbons of cloud that spread out, making the sky look overcast. They contain various toxic and biological substances. Paylock concentrates on the effects of enamel aluminum particles, as mentioned in part 2 of Chemtrails Over Las Vegas in the August 26th Las Vegas Tribune. Chemtrails are not admitted as a threat or as existing by government, but their existence occasionally comes out in media. TV station KBC Los Angeles, California, Toxic Sky with Paul Moyer, an account of sickness of children and record amounts of barium and aluminum in the water supply after chemtrails were seen over San Bernardino. In August 2005, the Las Vegas Tribune had a two-part article detailing the chemtrail over Las Vegas. That's one of the heaviest chemtrail areas in the world.
I wonder why.
I don't know. And the ensuing chemtrail sickness and previous chemtrail history from other sources. The Las Vegas Tribune report the U.S. Air Force on their website called chemtrails a chemical hoax. But scientists working at the Wright-Patterson Air Force Base confirmed the Ohio newspaper Columbus Alive that they were involved in aerial spraying experiments. One involved aluminum oxide spraying related to global warming, and the other involved barium stearate and had to do with high-tech military communications. Individuals who have noticed health problems die off of livestock crops concurrently with the appearance of chemtrails have investigated on their own, having their blood, soil, water, and atmosphere tested, made to compare with the norms. A compendium of these reports, both documented and anecdotal, is an on stage day strange skies online.
A website.
The documentary film, which What in the World Are They Spraying, produced by G. Edward Griffin, Michael Murphy, and Paul Winkler, shows the impact on the environment of chemtrails. For instance, the snow on Mount Shasta normally has 7 parts per billion of aluminum, but over the past 4 or 5 years has increased to 61,000 parts per billion. Imagine that. 7
wow.
parts to 61,000 parts. Soil in Northern California is turning alkaline, disrupting the root system of the trees. Farmers have noted that some plants will no longer grow in Hawaii. Fishermen see fewer bugs for the fish. There are a few examples from the above documentary. True to his specialty, Blaylock chooses to write about the neurotoxin non-aluminum, one of the main ingredients of today's chemtrails. He states in his articles that the studies have shown that these particles pass along the olfactory neural tract.
Which
connect directly to the area of the brain that is not only most affected by Alzheimer's disease, but also the earliest affected in the course of the disease. Aluminum nanoparticulates, particles that are also very easily absorbed from the GI tract, unlike ordinary aluminum that is usually not absorbed. Because of their small size, the nanoparticles can go in through the brain-blood barrier, penetrate the cell membranes, and disrupt the mitochondria.
Mm.
Nanoparticles can accumulate in the bone marrow, spleen, lymph nodes, and the heart, as reported in manufactured aluminum oxide. Nanoparticles decrease expression of tight junction proteins in brain vasculature. Published in the Journal of then inhaled, they inflame the lungs, bringing on asthma or other pulmonary ailments. In his article, Blaylock predicts an explosive increase in neurogenetic degenerative diseases occurring in adults and the elderly, and understanding rates as well as neurodevelopmental disorders in our children. If these clouds project, projects are not stopped. The danger to children is the greatest since they are more likely to be outside. Also, they are smaller, and not fully developed. Some of the advice from the Stop Spraying California website is to stay inside on chemtrail days, make lots of water, and eat ice cream. Chelating foods that flush toxic metals out of your system, such as chlorella and cilantro, they help. Remember to keep the immune system in top shape. So that's where we're going, guys. And this guy just discovered this a couple of years ago, but I mean, we found out about this back in about 2002 when we noticed it in this area, in a heavy, heavy area. And
well,
then,
I remember I had the sense that there were no sparkly winter days with the sun out, everything was all. Just let me finish
yeah,
what I was saying. And I really didn't say anything to anybody. I just had this feeling that there weren't very many sparkly, clear winter days that I used to have as a kid. And then we kind of ran into John Brennan, and he brought it up. And I said to him, is that why we don't have any sparkly days and there's no real sunshine? And he said, yeah, it's been going on for about a year or 2 years at that time.
That was back in 2002. 2003 when we met John, and he was giving a film presentation in our place, and we saw it and we were amazed because it answered all our questions as to what the hell was really going on.
That's right.
And ever since then we've been major chemtrail activists.
Trying to let people know about it.
And finally, 10 years later, after millions of people have come down with the damn disease, and they're starting to notice the activity in the sky, and they used to put it off as nothing. All right, and we were criticized. John was criticized.
Yeah, he really took a lot of the brunt of the criticism.
Yeah,
he really put himself out there.
And the absurdity of it is that
all they had to do was look up
and people refused to do that.
They looked up and they couldn't see what was there.
It's really good, but they refused to believe that they were being sprayed. Unbelievable how stupid people can absolutely be.
They're so brainwashed they can't see what's in front of their nose.
Unbelievable. But anyway, after 10 years, we finally got to a point where people are starting to waken up to this old fact and say, wait a minute, you can't do this. Unfortunately, by now, you got a million more Alzheimer's patients in this country and probably millions and millions of more around the world. I don't know how many people drink this crap, this 5-hour energy boost.
Which one is that? None of them are very good.
It only makes sense that if you take this crap and drink it, it does something to you, it's probably not good for you. Just like everything else that's on the market.
Just like a lot of other things.
So much stuff. So much crap.
Not everything.
But the 5-hour energy drinks lead to death, intelligence, and spontaneous emotion.
That's pretty scary.
Natural news. Researchers continue to discover more evidence that all of those energy drinks, which are pushed by high-profile athletes, sports companies, and the mainstream media, are not just bad for you, but downright dangerous.
Officials with the Food and Drug Administration say they've received reports of 13 deaths over the last 4 years where there was at least a casual link to the brand 5-Hour Energy. an energy shot that contains a potent amount of caffeine. The New York Times said that the disclosure of the reports was the second time in weeks that filings by the agency cited deaths linked to energy drinks. In October, the FDA said it had received the 5 reports involving fatalities that were linked to another popular energy drink, Monster Energy. The drinks have a growing history in the FDA since 2009. 5-Hour Energy has been included in about 90 filings with the agency. More than 30 involve serious or life-threatening problems such as heart attacks, convulsions, and at least one spontaneous abortion. We are unaware of any problems with our product. Granted, the simple filing of an incident with the FDA does not mean a certain product caused death or harm or even contributed it to it. But certainly the products in question are increasingly mentioned in reports to the government's investigative health agency. Living Essentials of Farmington Hills, Michigan, the distributor of 5-Hour Energy, did not respond to inquiries from the Times, and the company's top executives refused to be interviewed. But in a statement, the company claimed its product was safe when used as directed, adding that the firm was unaware of any deaths proven to have been caused by consuming of its product. Since disclosure of reports linking Monster Energy to potentially harmful incidents, the company has said repeatedly that its products are safe, insisting that the drink was not the cause of any health problems. The fast-growing energy drink industry has been facing increased scrutiny over the past few years over labeling disclosures and potential health risks, the paper says. The growing concern has stretched all the way to Capitol Hill, of course, as a number of lawmakers have begun calling on the FDA to increase regulation of energy drinks. In addition, the New York State Attorney General's office is investigating the practice of several of the drink producers. There are differences in the drinks themselves. Brands like Red Bull, Monster Energy, Rip It, and others actually look like beverages, but 5-Hour Energy is sold as a 2-ounce shot. And while the company doesn't disclose how much caffeine is in each container, a recent story by Consumer Reports said it was about 215 milligrams. That's about double the caffeine content in an 8-ounce cup of coffee, which can contain between 100 and 150 milligrams. No specific information tying energy drinks to death. At present, the FDA says it doesn't have the scientific evidence to regulate caffeine any more than the agency already does. Officials say the issue is made more complex by the fact that some high-caffeine drinks, such as Red Bull, are currently sold under FDA rules, while others, such as 5-Hour Energy and Monster Energy, are sold as dietary supplements. Different categories, different rules, and reporting requirements, neither of which would matter if better, more specific labeling of ingredients in all food products were the rule rather than the exception. In an interview with Time, David Fabricant, director of the FDA's Division of Dietary Supplementary Programs, said the agency was looking into death reports, citing 5-Hour Energy. But he said so far, the data was inconclusive. He said 13 death reports mentioning 5-Hour Energy had all been submitted to the agency by Life Essentials, but only because since 2008, dietary supplement producers have been required to notify the FDA when they are made aware of a death or other serious health incident that could be tied to their product. If you find yourself needing an energy boost of energy, try a natural energy booster, like an apple or something like that. Piece of cheese, something to...
Or even a normal cup of coffee. I mean, for crying out loud, you know, it's better than this crap.
Well, there's something that confuses me, though. They said it only has as much caffeine as 2 8-ounce cups of coffee.
Yeah, but it's not...
There must be something else in there.
It's not just that. It's the other ingredients.
Mixed with it.
There are a lot of some other stuff, you know, and you're dealing with... There's no sugar. It's probably aspartame in some of these things. and which can cause all kinds of neurological damage. And, you know, it's the combo that you have to deal with. And that's
the toxic mix.
Yeah, it's a real toxic mix. And that's the problem. I'm trying to find something that's non-Palestinian tonight until the latter part of the show. So we're not censored out of there. But I think the
they certainly spent a lot of time in European websites talking about the sex scandals in Europe and Britain.
Yeah, there's a tremendous number of sex scandals, especially some connected right to the Queen. This one concerned me, but I suspected it, but now there's proof. This is from Natural News as well, but it says mainstream media now openly admits the FBI and CIA are reading your emails.
Oh my God.
So I mean, if the mainstream media is telling you, then people want you to know. For years, those of us who have tried to warn the American public that Big Brother monitors all internet users were demonized, vilified, and ridiculed. Now the mainstream media has proven us correct. The U.S. government, and likely your own government for that matter, is either watching your online activity every minute of the day through automated methods and non-human eavesdropping techniques, or has the ability to dip in as and when it deems necessary, sometimes with a warrant, sometimes without. ZDNet reported earlier this month that a tinfoil hat really isn't going to help. Take it off. You look silly. The Petraeus case. Where is the proof that the government has this capability? You might recall a fellow by the name of retired General David Petraeus. He's been in the news lately. Before star general turned CIA chief, just resigned his post after news broke that he had engaged in an extramarital affair with his biographer, herself a West Point graduate and a former Army officer. This, what led to this shocking discovery was Petraeus' use of all things Google Online Email Services, or Gmail. Oh my God, what a fool. And according to a federal law, mind you, authorities are not legally permitted to electronically snoop around in your email box. The government can't just wander through your emails just because they'd like to know what you're thinking or doing. Stuart Baker, former Secretary of the Homeland Security Department, who's now in a private law practice, told the Associated Press. But if the government is investigating a crime, it is a lot of authority to review people's emails. Or, in the case of the CIA, if the agency wants to track a suspect ostensibly for national security purposes, ditto the NSA. The wrangling of Petraeus' email account has certainly landed him in a world of trouble. But his story has also once again ignited a new debate over when, how, and why governments and law enforcement agencies alike are able to access the email accounts of ordinary citizens, even if they head up the most powerful spy agency in the world. Granted, experts say the little people needn't worry much about having their online presence tracked. Agencies like the CIA generally tend to have bigger fish to fry, so to speak. But nevertheless, the technology to pilfer email accounts at will obviously exists. And forget Echelon, or signals intelligence, or the interception of communications by black boxes installed covertly in the data centers. Intelligence agencies and law enforcement bodies can access thanks to the shift toward web-based email service in the cloud, but it is not as exciting or as Jack Bauer-esque as one may think or hope for. Want to listen?
Sure. Point me in the right direction there.
Okay. How the CIA officially got busted.
When he set up his private Gmail account, Petraeus used a pseudonym and composed email messages but never sent them. They were instead saved as drafts. His lover, Paula Broadlow, would then log in under the same account and read the drafts and run a reply to them in the same manner as a draft without actually sending the message. How clever. The exchange would not be sent across the network through Google's data centers, which would make it nearly impossible for NASA or the Electronic Intelligence Agency like Britain's GCHQ or the Israeli Mossad to read the messages while they were in transit between accounts. Other sinister operators, terrorists, pedophiles, and the like, have been known to use the same trick to avoid detection. But surely IP addresses are logged and noted. When emails are sent and received, yes. But the emails were saved in drafts and therefore were not sent. However, Google may still have a record of the IP addresses of those who logged into the accounts, the report said. In the end, the FBI used a little-known law called the Stored Communications Act, which is part of the Electronic Communications Privacy Act, as a basis for getting a warrant to view Petraeus' private Gmail account. And that's how the agents found the stored messages that were never sent. Once it knew Miss Broadwell was the sender of the threatening messages, the FBI got a warrant that gave it covert access to anonymous emails to the anonymous email account, the BBC's Mark Ward reported. Pretty clever.
Clever but stupid.
But clever but stupid.
I mean, to go with Gmail. It's absurd. These guys are absolutely stupid.
Well, they thought they were really clever, I think.
Yeah, using Gmail.
We'll sign into the draft.
Her
name wasn't on that.
I closed my Gmail account because of the Google snooping aspect. And it more or less was a pain in the ass, too. But, I guess it's important to note this, and I find it, I wanted to talk about this tonight, but Americans can't pretend the U.S. is a neutral party in the Israeli assault on Gaza.
I thought we were
going to
play our audio first. I'd like to do that.
Well, I think it's important to replay it, but it's 22 minutes long.
Okay, I realize we want to play it at 8:30.
And we can play it at 8:30. But I'd like to read this article from my partner. Americans can't pretend the U.S. is a neutral party in the Israeli assault on Gaza. A central premise of U.S. media coverage of the Israeli attack on Gaza beyond the fact that Israel is justifiably defending it is that this is some endless conflict between two foreign entities. The Americans can simply sit by helplessly and lament the tragedy of it all. And the reality is precisely the opposite. Israeli aggression is possible only because of direct, affirmative, unstinting U.S. diplomatic, financial, and military support for Israel and everything it does. This self-flattering depiction of the U.S. as uninvolved neutral party is the worst media fiction since TV news personalities covered the Arab Spring by pretending that the U.S. is and long has been on the side of the heroic Democratic protesters, rather than the key force that spent decades propping up the Pyrenees they were fighting. Literally each day since the latest attacks began, the Obama administration has expressed its unqualified support for Israel's behavior. Just 2 days before the latest Israeli attacks began, Obama said, Palestinian Prime Minister Mahmoud Abbas, that his administration opposes a Palestinian bid for non-state membership of the UN, both the U.S. Senate and House, thus earning the ultimate DC reward, the Head Pat from AIPAC, which praised the extraordinary show of support by the Senate for Israel's struggle against terrorist attacks on civilians. More bipartisan congressional cheerleading is certain to come as the attacks continue, so no matter how much more brutal they become. In reflexive defense of Israel, the U.S. government thus once again put itself squarely at odds with key nations such as Turkey, whose prime minister accused Israel of being motivated by elections and demanded that that Israel be held to account for mounting civilian deaths, and Egypt, which denounced Israeli attacks as aggression against humanity, and Tunisia, which called on the world to stop the blatant aggression of Israel. And by rather stark contrast, Obama continues to defend Israel's free hand in Gaza, causing commenters like Jeffrey Goldberg to gloat, not inaccurately. Barack Obama hasn't turned against Israel. This is a big surprise to everyone who has not paid attention to the last 4 years. Indeed, there are few more compelling signs of how dumb and misleading U.S. elections are than the fact that the only criticism of Obama on Israel heard over the last year in the two-party debate was the grievance that Obama evinces insufficient fealty rather than excessive fealty to the Israeli government. Well, you know, what bugs me about that comment so much is that Romney is the biggest ass-kisser of Israel that ever existed, you know? You know, the guy's got his head so far up Israel and Netanyahu's ass, he needs an oxygen tank. You know, so it's like, it's like, come on. And of course, that the Netanyahu government knows that any attempt to condemn Israel at the UN would be instantly blocked by the U.S. is a major factor enabling them to continue however they wish. And of course, the bombs, planes, and tanks they are using are subsidized and substantially part of the U.S. taxpayer. If one wants to defend U.S. support for Israel on the merits, on the grounds that this escalating Israeli aggression against a helpless population is just and warranted, then one should do so. As I wrote on Thursday, it's very difficult to see how those who have cheered for Obama's foreign policy could do anything but cheer for Israeli militarism, as they are grounded in the same premises. But pretending that the U.S. and the Obama administration bear no responsibility for what is taking place is sheer self-delusion and total fiction. It has long been the case that the central enabling fact of Israeli lawlessness and aggression is blind U.S. support, and that continues more than ever to be the case under the presidency of the 2009 Nobel Peace Prize winner. And the Obama administration's unstinting financial, military, and diplomatic support for Israel is a key enabling force in the conflict. The U.S. is not neutral, uninvolved party. Whatever side of this conflict you want to defend, or if you're one of those people who love to announce that you just wish the whole thing to go away, it's still necessary to take responsibility for the key role played by the American government and this administration in enabling everything that is taking place. And, you know, I agree with this article 100% because, you know, but the one thing I don't agree with is what, you know, the United States is trapped. We're trapped. The people are trapped. In a vice, okay? of this Republican and Democratic duopoly, you know, this system, this insane system. And we have to accept the fact that it's going to win every election, you know.
Right.
So, you know, we have no choice, all right? But we have to look at things domestically as well as foreign policy. And unfortunately, Obama's foreign policy, believe it or not, was less aggressive than Romney's foreign policy.
Mm-hmm.
All right? So it's like, how can we win? How? The only way to win is a complete and utter revolution. But that ain't going to happen, folks. And the Americans are so sedated, you know, on fluoride and prescription medicines and every other god-awful, you know, probably the most medicated country in the world.
Oh, yeah. England's a fast second. Well, maybe they're even ahead of us.
Yeah, but there are only 40 million of those. There's 300 million of us.
That's true.
So it's like, you triple that number, and that's probably a quadruple, quintuple that number, and that's what you get for Americans. Everybody's on some kind of, dope. So it's like, that's where we're at. And we're being used.
Let's go to that audio piece, because I'm very anxious that we get a chance to hear the whole thing.
Yeah, there's one more thing, if we have time, Maria, is Gaza and the politics of greater Israel.
So we'll read that at the end.
Right, and why Gaza is in this situation that it's in. And what those bastards are trying to do. So, and what I'll do is I'd like to play this audio portion. It's a little long, about 22 minutes, but it's an interview done by an Israeli soldier, right? Now, you've got to remember, Israel minister vows Palestinian Holocaust also. Senior Israeli politician provoked controversy today when he warned that the Palestinian fire rockets from Gaza would be punished with a bigger Holocaust from Israel. And the use of the Hebrew word for Holocaust, Shoah, tends to be used exclusively in Israel to describe the Nazi persecution of Jews. However, the Palestinian activist routinely claimed to be suffering a Shoah at the hands of the Israelis. And by the Jewish state normally denies any moral equivalence between the suffering of the Palestinians today and the European Jewry under the Nazis.
Yeah.
Of death is death, folks. Genocide is genocide. Now, I'm going to go to this art of this, and I think we have to be happy with it. Hang on, folks. I'll be right with you here.
Yes.
next, or
I'm waiting for Leo to bring up the video from YouTube. Actually, we're going to hear the audio part, which is a perspective from an Israeli soldier's point of view about what's going on between the Palestinian movement and Israel. So he gives his viewpoint. It's really very good. And he points out a lot of things that I wasn't familiar with and can do a little more study on.
All right. So this is about 20 minutes long, but it's very good because it's about a soldier. And I'll just read it quickly. It says, former Israeli paratrooper Avner Gavyahu, now an activist with Breaking the Silence, explains to Green Left Weekly Peter Boyle how 850 former Israeli soldiers have been given testimony about the gross injustices against the Palestinian people they have witnessed and made to participate in as part of an Israeli military occupation of the West Bank and Gaza. It was visiting Australia to promote the book, Our Harsh Logic. Okay, we say this is zero. I hope you enjoy this book. It's quite eye-opening and revealing by an Israeli soldier.
What is the mission of Breaking the Silence?
So Breaking the Silence started as an organization in March 2004 by a group of soldiers that served in Hebron, which is one of the biggest cities in the West Bank, south of Jerusalem, during the peak of the Second Intifada. 22 Israelis killed in Hebron, out of them a 10-month-old baby in Shehevet Pass. 88 Palestinians were killed, 64 of them were not involved in any violence or any actions against the army or the settlers, and two of them were actually killed by settlers themselves, a 14-year-old and a 16-year-old. Now, this is what they were going through. And in this 1 year, even people that were totally with the mission, no questions, they realized that there's this crazy gap between what they're doing inside the army, day in and day out, and what their family, friends, communities know about back home. And this gap or this silence started to affect them, and they said, look, there's something is going on here. I mean, we're experiencing these things during our service, but we're coming home. We can't bring this home to our family's dinner table. And eventually, after finishing their 3 years of service, with questions, with thoughts, with discussions, they decided to put together an exhibition of pictures, of photos, of testimonies, very spontaneous, very not sophisticated, or very low-tech, and they thought this could start some sort of debate inside the Israeli society. Now, this debate actually was much wider than they expected, and thousands of people came to this very simple exhibition. They were also invited to show it in the Knesset, in the parliament, which today is unheard of, with probably one of the most right-wing governments we ever had. But maybe the most important thing that happened is that people from different units, different places, different times, came out and said, we can tell you the exact same story. And the story is not only a specific unit in Hebron in 2002, but the story is paratroopers in 2000 in Nablus, or Golani, which is another infantry brigade, in 2003 in Bethlehem. And they realize this isn't the specific story of a specific unit, but the story of a generation. I served from November 2004 to 2007. What we do today in the organization is we focus on three major things. The first, the heart of our work, is gathering testimonies, having the information brought to the public, that we can have a real debate about what is happening and what is the moral price we're paying for controlling 4 million people. We do educational work, bringing people to tours in Hebron or in the South Hebron Hills using our testimonies. And the third part of our work is lobby work, because we understand that it can't only stay within the realm of a very specific group or community, but the idea is to increase resistance to the occupation. And increase resistance to occupation has to also go through political levels, also with the help of journalists. And this isn't only something that could stay or change with doing only educational work.
So what's the sort of experience while serving that actually gets a soldier to take what's quite a big step to speak out against the Israeli armed forces.
My dad was a paratrooper. I'm named after a paratrooper that was killed in the Yom Kippur War, 1973. This is an important, you know, it's not something that starts when you enlist in the army, right? It's actually Israel, if you like it or not, especially big, not all communities, but big parts of the communities are very militaristic. I mean, it's part of our society, it's part of our community. In the communities that do join the army, and not everyone joins the army, but in the communities that do join the army, it's very clear that this is your next step after high school. So when I turned 18, I did the year of community service, but after that year I joined the army, I went to the paratroopers, I felt that I'm continuing, you know, my family heritage or what I was supposed to do. And I have to say that I did enter the army with questions, but maybe not the right questions, maybe not all the questions, but I did, you know, feel that I'm like a good Jew. This is what I was told in yeshiva. You have to walk around with question marks around your head. So I think I went into the army feeling I have the question marks. And the question marks is, how will I be a good soldier in a shitty situation? How will I be a good soldier in a bad situation? And I thought I could be that soldier standing in a checkpoint and smiling while cars passing by. Or I could enter a house but walk around with candies in my pockets and conduct a moral occupation, right? Which took me a while, but I realized this is a contradiction in terms. And when we started actually doing our actual service after almost a year, a couple of months of training, we started entering houses on a nightly basis. Searching houses on nightly basis, or going in to arrest people in the middle of the night, you realize that it's impossible to be moral in an immoral situation. And I think this is something that's extremely difficult for us to explain. I mean, we've been touring the States for 3 weeks, and we came here from Australia with a book, which is called Our Harsh Logic. And I think the best understanding of what this harsh logic is, understanding what the soldier is going through in his mindset. And as a soldier, you rationalize situations. Now, your mission is to enter a house because this is what you were asked to do. It doesn't matter how big your smile will be to the family, you're disrupting their day-to-day life. And when the orders we got were instill the sense of someone of fear, or to instill a sense of someone is chasing you, or to brand the consciousness of Palestinians, or like I said before, to disrupt the day-to-day life of Palestinian population, this is what it looks like. And there's no way to do it nicely.
It's a further step. Behaviors like systematic humiliation, you know, even reaching to assault and torture.
There's many ways I can approach this, but I think it's important to understand the three kinds of testimonies we gather. The two extreme kinds of testimonies we gather. One extreme is what we all refer to as extreme cases, right? What beating up, stealing, humiliating, taking pictures with dead bodies, or taking pictures with tied up Palestinians. We all know this happens. There's footage of this, there's discussions of this. How most Israelis deal with this is they find a scapegoat. They say it's the soldier's fault, specifically him. What you have to do is enforce the law even harder on the soldiers. This is if you think it's a problem. There's many people that some of these incidents aren't even. We're only talking about people that find this as a problem. The other kind of testimony are illegal things that happen. For example, using a human shield. Happened in the West Bank in 2003. There was a Palestinian that was killed after soldiers entered the house, used him as a human shield. He was injured and killed. And the Supreme Court decided this was illegal. We have testimonies of soldiers doing this in 2005, in 2006, and so on and so forth. 2009, there was a very a famous case in Operation Cast Lead of using the human shield. Illegal, right? Shooting white phosphorus, and so on and so forth. Also, the illegal things, when people find that they're a problem, also a lot of people don't think they're even a problem, right? But people who find them problematic will say, well, it's illegal, it's very clear what you have to do. You have to sent to jail. But the heart of the testimony, right, the ground of the how these actions are growing, is the day-to-day life, is the routine, are the things that no one questions, right? For example, entering a house for military purposes, what is called a straw widow. I took part in numerous straw widows. This is something that happens around the West Bank. Not really questioned, not considered illegal, not considered extreme. But when you have the order to enter a house and eventually do whatever you like in the house because you need it for military purposes, it's a very slippery slope. Because when you enter a house and only use it for an observation point, what do you do when your water is finished? And there's no other way to get water to you. Do you drink water or you don't drink water? What happens if your food finishes? Right? So when we're sitting here very comfortably, we say, of course, it's immoral to take someone's water or food without permission. Even though it's very easy to get permission when you have a helmet and gun, right? No one will say no to you. But this doesn't end. Like, what happens when you, if you have to take a shower in the house? And if you're in the house suddenly for 48 hours or 3 days? And if you're allowed to sit on the sofa, allowed to put your legs on the table? The thing is that it's extremely easy to sterilize the discussion, right, and say, well, it's very clear, it's either this or that. But the truth of the matter is, when you're standing in a checkpoint, you can be nice for the first hour. But after 4 hours of being hungry and hot or cold and pissed off, and the only way you can actually control people is by force, that's what you're going to do. And it's not a chance that we see the same testimonies coming up at the beginning of the Second Intifada, in the middle of the past decade, and yesterday, you know, or tonight, we'll go today, we'll go see what's happening in the West Bank. We'll see similar stories.
I mean, is there any kind of de facto, or maybe even officially sanctioned or promoted, you know, racist culture that acts as a justifying or, you know, motivating force? Is this part of the reality of Israeli occupation?
It has to be part. It has to be part. In order to understand what is happening in the occupation, this is where there is a difference between what's happening in the rest of Israel, is in the West Bank and in the Gaza Strip. Everything is, of course, is under Israeli control in the wider sense. There's a difference between Israel's control in the West Bank and Israel's control in Gaza, but we are still controlling both pieces of land. The law there, and it doesn't matter what your politics are, is a different law than the rest of Israel. Right? We're talking about one area that has civilian law, right, where people have the right to vote, where people have a political power, people can go out to the street and demonstrate, and it's legal. In the West Bank, it's army law. It's martial law. And it's not by the people for the people. It's by Israel for Israel. Now, of course, this is every occupation. This isn't new. But two important things we have to remember. First of all, this has been going on for 45 years. And as we see on the ground, and this is part of what we're trying to show with the book, there's no exit strategy. We're working on the ground with no end in sight. The second thing is, we started for different reasons, ideological reasons, security reasons, some people would say, to mobilize Jewish communities from Israel into the West Bank. And when we started to mobilize them, we created a situation that de facto, there is never a possibility for equality. Because you're talking about 350, together with East Jerusalem, half a million Jewish settlers that are under Israeli civilian law. And 2.5 million Palestinians that are under army law, under martial law. Right? They'll never be equal. If you have two people meeting in the heart of Hebron, both in the same exact moment pick up a rock and throw it at each other, but one is Palestinian, one is Israeli, the Israeli would be tried under civilian law. Right? The Palestinian would be tried as a terrorist, doing the exact same thing. Now, we can go on and give more examples with mistreating of children, right, which a Palestinian child will not be treated the same as an Israeli child because there's a different law. That's where we understand that there'll never be equality, and there'll always be, you could call it racism, and I think this oriented part of the story. And the bottom line, the idea of differentiating between two populations is part of the story and part of what we talk about in the book that I'm here to promote is the idea of separation. This is the second chapter of the book. Most people really think that we're spending most of our time separating Israelis from Palestinians, but that's only part of what we're doing. They're already separated by law, but we're also doing another thing, which is separating Palestinians from Palestinians. And that's actually what we're spending most of our time doing. And this idea of a separation is already implemented on the ground. When we actually broke down what we see the occupation is into four pillars, right? The occupation is a chair, the four legs of the chair, where these are actually terms that most soldiers know about, and actually even most Israelis know about, but they're referred to in a positive connotation. The first one is prevention, right? You prevent something bad from happening to someone good, can't be bad. Separation, like I mentioned, most of the international community is talking about a two-state solution, that's separation. Isn't initially evil, right? We can debate if it's the right solution or not, but the third is fabric of life, allowing the Palestinians to maintain their fabric of life. Sounds excellent. And law enforcement. And what we try to do in the book is actually to break that down and to discover what these terms actually mean. In Hebrew, the word prevention means tikkul. When you tell an Israeli sikul, the first thing that comes to mind is sikul memukad, targeted prevention, which is the best way to translate it, or targeted killing, assassinations. You have a ticking bomb scenario, Palestinian strapped with a bomb to him, leaving a big Palestinian city to a major Israeli city. Isn't new, this happened. Happened during the Second Intifada. I remember, you know, being scared driving in buses in Jerusalem and Tel Aviv. This is something that we remember. And we have to stop this ticking bomb scenario, and we use this tool, which is called targeted killing, assassination. This, I think, most of Israelis will agree is something we have to do. This already went up to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court, you can use this tool of targeted assassinations only in the case of a ticking bomb scenario. But this is only the tip of this idea. We actually made it wider and wider and wider. And we continued on using this tool of targeted assassinations and killing people that aren't a ticking bomb scenario, but could be involved in violence, could be involved with what Israel sees as terror against Israelis or settlements, and could definitely people that Israel could arrest, but we couldn't get our hands on them, so we assassinated.
I wanted to, before I end tonight, I wanted to try to read this particular article, if we can get it.
So you're ending that?
Yeah.
You should explain that and tell people where to go.
Oh, you can go to
YouTube. You chopped it up.
I'm sorry. You can get that article on YouTube. Go to Green Left, Occupation of Israel, and check it out from there. But it's definitely something that you should look into. I just wanted to read, if I can get a chance to read this one, this article before we end tonight. But I probably won't get a chance because it's almost 9 o'clock.
Well, why don't you tell people what the article is and
the article,
they can go for it.
You can go to the David Icke website, davidicke.com, and check this out. And it's one article is on the Israeli minister vows Palestinian Holocaust, but the other is on the explanation of Gaza in Israel's... where is it? Damn it.
Well, anyway, they can go to the David Icke headline website.
Also note that thousands of students hold anti-Israeli demonstration in Egypt, there's a lot of pressure from that country to try to invade Egypt, actually, and try to I guess
no,
they,
not to invade.
No, they're not invade Egypt. They invade Israel. They'd like to go to war with Israel. Actually, they hate Israel. And some interesting articles there. So we'll leave it at that. For some reason, I can't find that other article. Probably just as well.
But folks can find it on the website.
Yeah, find it on the website.
Go to davidicke.com headlines. And you just scroll down the site and you'll see that there's several articles on the Palestinian-Israeli conflict.
There's another one. Gaza War is a cover for the Israeli occupation. That's a very interesting video as well. And we'll leave it at that.
So we thank you for listening to us tonight. I hope you've listened to some things that give you pause to think, make some decisions about what you're listening to. From the mainstream media.
I want to congratulate Anonymous for attacking the Israeli websites. 44 million cyber attacks on government websites in Israel. I mean, there's a war against Israel, and it's a worldwide war.
Well, what they're doing is they're doing the same thing that was done in South Africa to the black people, except Israel is doing it to Palestinians, and worse.
It's apartheid.
And we're supporting it, and it's disgraceful that we're supporting it.
It definitely is, and hopefully we can end it, and hopefully this show will get out.
And other people are speaking out, too.
Yes.
Well, I think that Israeli soldier was very brave to speak out about it.
He was, and I hope you can go to that, if you can get that on YouTube.
So thanks for listening to us tonight, folks, and tune in tomorrow night. We'll be talking about union issues.
Yeah.
And have a great night.